Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. A quick community update on an upcoming event in Houston, and that is the Palestinian American Cultural Center's annual gala. It will be held this year on Saturday, September 10th, 2022, under the theme Reclaim, Return, Rebuild. The keynote speaker will be Noura Ariqat, author, human rights attorney, and associate professor at Rutgers University. For more information on this event, visit www.pacchouston.org. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1024, I will air a lecture titled The Invention of Sectarianism in the Modern Middle East by Professor Osama Maqdisi. He delivered that lecture on September 20th, 2017 at an event organized by the Center for the Middle East at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Osama Maqdisi is a professor of history, author, and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair of Arab Studies at Rice University in Houston. Let's listen to Dr. Osama Maqdisi's lecture. The voice you will hear first is that of Alan Marisol with the Baker Institute, introducing Professor Osama Maqdisi.
I'm Alan Marisol, Associate Director of the Baker Institute, and I'm pleased to welcome everybody to tonight's event. In 1995, the Arab American Educational Foundation, which is a foundation here in the city, created an endowment at Rice University for Arab studies. And after a two-year search, the university appointed as the first holder of that chair our speaker tonight, Osama Maqdisi, who at that time was a newly minted Princeton PhD. Since then, he's had a very distinguished Rice career. 3 years after he got his PhD, he published his first book, which was called The Culture of Sectarianism, Community, History, and Violence in 19th Century Ottoman Lebanon. This was a remarkable first book, and it got very enthusiastic reviews from the journals. It's a work of passion. It's a deeply researched work, and it argues a very subtle and important thesis. American policymakers, the American public may think that sectarian conflict has roots that go back to the ancient world, but he argues that, in fact, sectarianism is a product of modernity. He focuses on Lebanon in 1840 to 1860, and he shows in that case how modern forces created this modern phenomenon. Since then, he fulfilled the promise of that first book and has become one of the leading scholars in the field of Arab history. And one reason why we know that is all the awards that have honored him. He has, for example, been a resident scholar in Turkey, Beirut, Berlin, Paris, and Harvard. He's received grants from the American Council of Learned Societies, the Woodrow Wilson Foundation. He's been a Carnegie Scholar. He publishes in the leading journals, including the American Historical Review and the Journal of Middle Eastern Studies. And all that time, as he was building up his career, he was here at Rice as a teacher. And there is one award that he got that I would mention in particular, which was his award in 2008 for superior teaching, the George R. Brown Award for Superior Teaching, which is voted by students. And I would like to emphasize that because I think it's a special award. What Osama teaches is highly controversial. In fact, it's inflammatory. And the students who voted him this award were not only honoring him for his learning, but for his tact in negotiating a very difficult subject. He was, of course, writing more books, Artillery of Heaven, American Missionaries and the Failed Conquest of the Middle East, 2008, Faith Misplaced, The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations, 1820 to 2001. Public policy institutes like this one bring to the podium people who make policy, people who defend policy, and critics of policy. Usama is a critic. He is a scholar of the modern Arab world, including post-World War II era when the United States replaced Great Britain as the great power in the region. He believes that the Americans made very serious mistakes in the conduct of their policy in that region, not least of which is their assumption of American benevolence. So he is not a scholar who comforts or entertains. He's a scholar who challenges. And I expect that that will be the case tonight. His subject is the book he's working on, not yet published, called The Ecumenical Frame, Coexistence and Sectarianism in the Modern Middle East. What this means is, I believe, that he will try out ideas he's still working on. And he's going to try them out on you. So pay attention and tell him what you think. So I would like to welcome to the podium tonight my friend and colleague of 20 years, Usama Makhtasi.
Thank you so much, Alan, Professor Madiso, and I am going to challenge you and hopefully not bore you. Alan is telling me, ditch the talk, just speak. I could do that, but let me start with a bit of reading and then we'll see where we go. Alan said, I'm going to challenge you. So your first task is to learn a few Arabic words and a few Ottoman words, which I'll come to in the talk. Hopefully it'll make sense by the end of my lecture. Of course, I'd like to thank Alan for that generous introduction. I'd like to thank Ambassador Jurijian. I'd like to thank the Baker Institute and the staff for hosting me here this evening. As I do talk a little bit about my new book, or at least the manuscript of my new book, which is about coexistence, the history of coexistence in the modern Middle East. And the book begins with a sentence, which is that there is no history of sectarianism that's not also a history of pluralism. Or to put it in the positive terms, every history of sectarianism is also a history of pluralism. And the reason I say that is because the history of the Middle East and the history of the Middle East in the 18th and 19th centuries and into the 20th century, in fact, all the way until today, is a history of extraordinary beauty and pluralism and diversity, and also a history and a region rife with extraordinary challenges. And as Alan said, not I, empire and imperialism, but I'll say it too, empire and imperialism and all sorts of challenges. And so the term sectarianism that you have all heard and we've all heard, we've been exposed to with an extraordinary degree after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, remains, as far as I can tell, one of the most overused and least historicized, under-theorized concepts when we think about the Middle East. So think about the term sectarianism and how it's used in typical journalistic fashion or even in many academic works. The term sectarianism can mean any number of things. It can mean pervasive forms of prejudice. It can mean the identification with a religious or ethnic community as if that community were a political party. It can also mean, and is used to mean, the mobilization of various communities or individuals belonging to particular communities, whether Sunni or Shi'i, Christian or Jewish, through which political, economic, and social claims are made in multi-religious and multi-confessional societies or states or polities. The term sectarianism is also used, to add to the confusion, to denote outright communal mobilizations and massacres. For example, what is happening or what's been happening in Iraq since 2003, what's happening in Syria, what happened in India in the Gujarat genocide or massacres in 2001. But no matter what the term sectarianism actually denotes, the description of sectarianism, when it comes to the Middle East and when it comes to the modern contemporary Middle East, invariably assumes one thing, and that is that sectarianism corresponds, this is at least what we are told and what we are essentially bombarded with, that sectarianism denotes or comports or equates almost simply, very simply, with the reality of the Middle East of religious diversity. It's as if being a religiously diverse region means being a sectarian region. It's as if you just add geopolitics and the Middle East will explode. It's as if the people in the Middle East are always on the edge of a sectarian volcano. That, at least, is the common assumption with which I see how the Middle East is being reported. Now, understanding geopolitics is, of course, crucial. It's crucial to understanding why it is that a country like Syria today is unraveling, why it is that Iraq has unraveled. But to my mind, sectarianism is not simply, and has never simply been, the practice of discrimination or outright violence or a contest over resources in a multi-religious society. It has also been, from its inception as a word in political Arabic in the 20th century, it's also been a term, a judgment, a discourse, a deliberate invocation of an idea to label other people, other groups, other individuals. Because as far as I can tell, no group in the world has ever described itself as, in the Middle East at least, as overtly sectarian. Nobody parades or says, I am sectarian. People are always labeled as sectarian. Modern empires and modern nation states, including virtually the United States and all the states in the region in the Middle East, and their ideologues and camp followers, describe others as sectarian to justify policies, to justify the failure of policies, and to suggest the violent, irrational, and tribal antithesis of their civilization and their nationalism, an antithesis that has to be suppressed, managed, or maintained. So let me go back to what the former president, President Barack Obama, said in April 2016 in an interview in The Atlantic magazine, when he expressed his frank disappointment with the Middle East. He said, and I'm quoting, "You've got countries that have very few civic traditions, so that as autocratic regimes start fraying, the only organizing principles are sectarian," end quote. Now, this description of the Middle East by then-President Obama is not only patently absurd, it's also extraordinarily misleading. It's also highly ideological. What the then-President Obama said, and what countless American commentators today still tell us about the Middle East, reflects, I think, far less about the objective history or reality of the Middle East than about their assumptions and their stereotypes about this region. Think indeed for a moment, challenge yourselves. Think indeed of how today we use the words Arab and Jew as oppositional categories, without ever wondering or thinking why it is that the term Arab, which could and should in its most ideal form encompass Muslim, Christian, and Jew, why it is that today it has become oppositional to the word Jew. Why is it? What happened? When did this happen? Think about how in our own era, especially after the US invasion of Iraq in 2003, that we started to refer to Saddam Hussein as, quote, a Sunni dictator. Although he belonged to a party, nominally at least, certainly by the end of his life, nominally, he belonged to a party that began decades before as a secular pan-Arab party whose founders in Syria were Muslim and Christian, and in fact included Alawis as well. Think of all, most of all, about how Western journalism and scholarship about the Middle East and pundits who talk about the Middle East routinely identify individuals in the Middle East, almost without fail, as belonging to this or that community, so that people are always referred to as Sunni or Shi'i, as Christian or as Muslim, no matter what they themselves say. It doesn't matter if they call themselves secular, they're always being portrayed or represented as belonging to this or that community, which is the equivalent of referring to Americans as white or black or Latino every time you refer to them, no matter how they themselves identify themselves. It's not to say, of course, that there aren't significant, pertinent racial identities in this country or ethnic identities or sectarian identities in the Middle East. Of course there are, but people are often referred to and put in these boxes from which they can't, in a sense, escape. So if there's anything I'd like you to remember when we get to the Q&A, it's that I do not believe in sectarianism with a capital S. There is no such thing as sectarianism that floats above history. There's no such thing that we should think of in the medieval world that's the same as what's happening today. Today's events, today's context are completely different. Like the pernicious concept of race and the idea of races, sects do not simply exist. They are manufactured, and they are produced over and over again every single day. It takes a huge amount of work to mobilize people. It doesn't just happen naturally. The U.S. historian Barbara Fields has described the production of racecraft in this country, and we might well think of sectcraft along the same lines. That is to say, prejudice and religious identities alone do not make sectarianism. Politics, mobilization, historical and sociological context do. And above all, interpretation does. To be clear, again, I don't deny, and nobody who works in the Middle East can deny that sectarian mobilizations are occurring. Nobody can deny that sectarian affiliations in the Middle East are meaningful in particular contexts. But insofar as we can discern a communal or caste problem in India, a racial problem in this country and in Europe, then obviously we can also discern a sectarian problem in the Middle East. I do disagree, however, very strongly with narratives, as I've suggested, that assume that sectarianism is either inevitable or that it reflects an atavistic, a primordial, an age-old condition on the part of people in the Middle East. There's a huge difference between saying people take religion seriously and religion means something and sectarian identities mean something in the Middle East and actually explaining what is happening today in Syria and Iraq. In other words, what happens between identity and violence is the whole range of history that our job and your job is to interpret rationally and humanistically. Where then should I begin the story of sectarianism and its twin, pluralism or coexistence, in the Middle East? Well, I would begin in the 19th century, and the reason why I begin in the 19th century is because, first of all, it's clear to me that when we think about sectarianism in the Middle East today, we're talking about modern contexts, modern nation states, and contests and mobilizations that involve almost always outside powers as well as internal actors. So there's no point talking about medieval history, because what's happening today has almost nothing to do with the medieval period and almost everything to do with our contemporary modern context. And there are three reasons why I say the 19th century. First, because the region of what we today call the Middle East, the Arab world, was in the 19th century, and in fact, from 1516 and 1517, part of the Ottoman Empire, a massive, long-standing, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multilinguistic imperial system that ruled over the Arab world, as I said, from 1516, 1517, all the way until the First World War. And when this empire began to collapse or began to weaken substantially in the 19th century, it opened up all sorts of possibilities for reimagining what was to become of this world. The point also I want to make is that the sectarian questions that we think of today, Muslim versus Christian, Arab versus Jew, and today most obviously Sunni versus Shi'i, are all products, or in a sense all emerge out of the end of the Ottoman Empire and the post-Ottoman world. The first major urban massacres that took place against Christians in the Arab provinces occurred in the middle of the 19th century. The most infamous massacre of Christians in Damascus took place in 1860. It didn't happen in 1760, nor in 1660, nor in 1560. It happened in 1860 for reasons that I can get into later. In other words, there were economic, political, cultural, and social conditions that led to a specific mid-19th century sectarian crisis. And to begin to think about a sectarian crisis in the 19th century as today means to ask these kinds of questions. Who's involved? What are the social conditions? What are the economic conditions? What are the cultural conditions? And above all, what are the political conditions? What is the role of the Ottoman state? What is the role of foreign, especially European powers that began to intervene in this part of the world in the 19th century in an extraordinarily aggressive fashion? So the issue for me is not Islam or Christianity. It's not the Quran or the Bible. leave those aside for the moment. It's all about, in a sense, history and context and geopolitics. The second reason why I begin in the 19th century is that when we think about sectarianism and coexistence, we're thinking almost always about a problem of equality. And when we think about a problem of equality and secular equality, we're talking about a modern condition of states. And so the problems of sectarianism are related to the problems of nationalism, to the problems of citizenship, and to the problem of political equality, irrespective of religious affiliation, which is a problem that almost every major power and state in the 19th century, and in fact in the 20th century, and even as we see in the US today, in the 21st century, every major state deals with and grapples with. My point is that many states in the 19th century grappled with new ideas of secular citizenship and equality and struggled to reconcile these ideas of secular equality, which is an extraordinarily noble idea. How do you reconcile that with a history of long-standing religious or racial difference, discrimination, and oppression? To put the point in maybe the simplest and crudest terms, at the same time as the United States struggled with slavery and the question of black emancipation, and Europe struggled with the question of the Jewish question and the emancipation of Jews in Europe, the Ottoman Empire was confronted with its own question of what is the place of non-Muslims in what had always been an Islamic empire, the Ottoman Muslim Empire. The U.S., after all, for those who think that the sectarianism is a Middle Eastern condition, just consider the fact that the U.S. witnessed and endured a civil war and countless bouts of race rioting at this before, after, and during the time that the Ottoman Empire witnessed, as I said, let's say, a sectarian crisis manifested in the mid-19th century, which was all about what is the place of non-Muslims in an Islamic state. My point, of course, is not to pretend that non-Muslims in the Ottoman Empire occupied the same place that African Americans occupied in the United States. There's no question. Blacks in this country were oppressed and were under slavery, and that is no comparison to the conditions of non-Muslims in the Ottoman Empire. There were no ghettos, really, as far as I'm aware, in the Ottoman Empire. There's no question that blacks were fundamentally more oppressed. Rather, my point is to suggest that what race has been to America, religion has been to the Middle East, perceived as stable and obvious categories, but whose political implications, in fact, have changed radically over and across the 19th and 20th centuries. So in other words, if in America, as we all know, race or the question of race has defined, undercurrented, contradicted, and rendered ambivalent the meaning of U.S. citizenship, it goes to the very heart, we see this again playing out today, of what it means to be an American. In the Ottoman Middle East and in the post-Ottoman Middle East, in fact, until today, the question of religious difference has haunted an incomplete, paradoxical, and often contradictory 19th century project of equal citizenship. The difference, however, between the Arab world or the Ottoman Empire and the West is that the Arabs have hardly affected, intervened, and transformed the nature of modern Europe or the United States to the same degree that Europeans and Americans have transformed and still transform, obviously, the Arab world. So this brings me to my third point. So the point number one is why the 19th century is the Ottoman context. Point number two, it's a global question and problem where everyone is trying to figure out how do you reconcile equality with difference. And point number three, just as important, the question of foreign intervention and imperialism. Because beginning in the 19th century, Western imperial powers, this is before the British and the French, before the Americans, it's the British and the French, as Alan pointed out. This was when British and French and Russian and Austrian powers began to intervene massively in the history and in the affairs of the Ottoman Empire. And of course, the most famous of these is Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence. There is simply no way to understand anything that happens in the Middle East without acknowledging at the outset, frankly, how Western powers emerged or went from being factors, players, and agents in what remained a sovereign Ottoman Empire to being the powers that shaped the post-Ottoman Middle East. So they go from being factors to being the architects of the entire, of what we today call the Arab world. And so there is a brute reality of Western involvement in the Middle East that I don't think for a moment can be denied or obscured or rendered secondary to what the late Fuad Ajami tendentiously referred to as, quote, the self-inflicted wounds that he said matter more. There's no such thing as a self-inflicted wound. There are self-inflicted wounds that work always in tandem with Western power. They go together, they create each other. There's a dialectic. Remember that in the map of the modern world of today, Lebanon, the state of Lebanon was created by the French in 1920. Syria was also created by the French in 1920, and it was in fact divided. Israel, Palestine, the Mandate of Palestine, these are the mandates, by the way. The Mandate of Palestine, which becomes the State of Israel, again, was impossible without British intervention. Iraq was creation of the British, and so on and so forth. There is no way to understand any of this without understanding this this history. Does that mean that the West is to blame for everything? No, of course not. But does it mean that the West is implicated in virtually every major shift in the region beginning in the 19th century? And the answer is yes. There is no history, in other words, of the modern Middle East that's not also a history of British, French, and today American intervention and imperialism as well. Now, as far as the question of sectarianism goes and coexistence, what I'd like to talk about now briefly is how European interventions in the 19th century helped shape the first sectarian polity. So today everyone knows about Lebanon, that Lebanon and the country, they divide formal government between Muslims and Christians so that a Maronite Christian is the president, a Sunni Muslim is a prime minister, a Shia Muslim is a speaker of parliament, and that's the same model that the U.S. took to Iraq after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where the U.S., you know, essentially, not necessarily legally, but essentially divided Iraq into, quote, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. And so the same idea, the sectarian sort of method, the first and most important of these systems that was set up in the Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire was set up in what is today Lebanon, at the time Mount Lebanon, in 1861, following a massacre that took place of Christians in Damascus in 1860 and in Mount Lebanon in June of 1860 and in July of 1860. Now, as I said, I'm not going to give you a long history about the massacres, why they occurred, what happened. Suffice it to say that there were all sorts of reasons, including European intervention, including local interpretations of Ottoman reform, including Ottoman government. And there was all these reasons that led to the massacre of Christians, because this was a moment, again, as I said, where the empire was shifting from being an empire of Muslims over non-Muslims to being an empire where all Ottomans were ostensibly equal subjects. And this was a very difficult transition. And there was a moment in 1860 where Christians were massacred in this exceptional episodic time, 1860, July 1860, this major massacre that takes place. The European solution, the Europeans intervene, they send an army to Syria, to what is today Lebanon and Syria. The Ottomans send an army as well, and the Europeans insist that henceforth in Lebanon, in what Mount Lebanon, direct Ottoman rule over its subjects cannot continue. What there has to be is a sectarian administration. So the first sectarian administration that becomes the precursor to today's Lebanese state was set up in Mount Lebanon in 1861, when the Europeans decided that Ottomans could not directly rule their own subjects, their own Christian subjects. They had to be mediated by European controls. And so they created the sectarian system where they divided up Mount Lebanon into the administration of Mount Lebanon into various sort of communities, and they said that the administrative council, the ruling body of this province, will include two members from each major community. So they divided up, you know, so Maronites get this, Greek Orthodox get this, Greek Catholics get this, Sunni Muslims get this, Druze get this, and so on and so forth. And so they adopted a formal sectarian principle, and the idea was that is the way, and that is the only way to rule a multi-religious landscape equitably. You divide it up formally, which is exactly what the U.S. will do ostensibly in Iraq after 2003. Now, note that the U.S., neither the U.S. nor Britain nor France use the same idea for themselves. They don't divide France or Britain or the United States along formal racial lines, for instance, even though the United States, of course, witnessed a massive civil war and massacres and race riots that put the Damascus massacre, not that one should ever compare killings or massacres, but it's not like this is the only part of the world where you've had inequality and violence against others.
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT.